Most of the authors of several best-selling nutrition books claim to be researchers, but I am not aware that their research involves original, professionally developed experimentation. That is, they have not designed and conducted studies under the scrutiny of fellow colleagues or peers. They have few or no publications in peer-reviewed scientific journals. They have virtually no formal training in nutritional science. They belong to no professional research societies. They have not participated as peer reviewers. They do, nonetheless, often develop very lucrative projects and products that put money in their pockets while leaving the reader with yet another short-lived and useless diet fad. If you are familiar with the health books at your nearby bookstore, you have likely heard of Dr. Atkins's New Diet Revolution, the South Beach Diet, Sugar Busters, The Zone, Eat Right for Your Type, or other like-minded titles proposing low-carb diets, not so subtly meaning diets high in protein and fat. These titles have made health information more confusing, more difficult to grasp, and ultimately more elusive. If you aren't fatigued, constipated, or half-starved by these quick-fix plans, your head is spinning from counting calories and measuring grams of carbohydrates, protein, and fat. What's the real problem anyway? Is it fat? Is it carbohydrates? What's the ratio of nutrients that provides greatest weight loss? Are cruciferous vegetables good for my blood type? Am I taking the right supplements? How much vitamin C do I need every day? Am I in ketosis? How many grams of protein do I need? You get the picture. This is not health. These are fad diets that embody the worst of medicine, science, and the popular media. If you are only interested in a 2-week menu plan to lose weight, then this book is not for you. I am appealing to your intelligence, not to your ability to follow a recipe or menu plan. I want to offer you a more profound and more beneficial way to view health. I have a prescription for maximum health that is simple, easy to follow, and offers more benefits than any drug or surgery without any of the side effects. This prescription isn't merely a menu plan. It doesn't require daily charts or calorie counting, and it doesn't exist to serve my own financial interests. I am selling no products or services. Most importantly, the supporting evidence is overwhelming. This is about changing the way you eat and live, and the extraordinary health that will result. So, what is my prescription for good health? In short, it is about the multiple health benefits of consuming whole, plant-based foods, and the largely unappreciated health dangers of consuming animal-based foods, including all types of meat, dairy, and eggs. I did not begin with preconceived ideas, philosophical or otherwise, to prove the worthiness of whole foods, plant-based diets. I started at the opposite end of the spectrum, as a meat-loving dairy farmer in my personal life, and an establishment scientist in my professional life. I even used to lament the views of vegetarians as I taught nutritional biochemistry to pre-med students. My only interest now is to explain the scientific basis for my views in the clearest way possible. Changing dietary practices will only occur and be maintained when people believe the evidence and experience the benefits. People decide what to eat for a number of reasons, health considerations being only one. My task is only to present the scientific evidence in a form that can be understood. The rest is up to you. The scientific basis for my views is largely empirical, obtained through observation and measurement. It is not illusory, hypothetical, or anecdotal. It is from legitimate research findings. It is a type of science originally advocated 2,400 years ago by the father of medicine, Hippocrates, who said, "There are, in effect, two things, to know and to believe one knows. To know is science. To believe one knows is ignorance." I plan to show you what I have come to know. Much of my evidence comes from human studies done by myself and by my students and colleagues in my research group. These studies were diverse both in design and in purpose. They included an investigation of liver cancer in Philippine children and their consumption of a mold toxin, aflatoxin. A nationwide program of self-help nutrition centers for malnourished preschool children in the Philippines. A study of dietary factors affecting bone density and osteoporosis in 800 women in China. A study of biomarkers that characterize the emergence of breast cancer. And a nationwide, comprehensive study of dietary and lifestyle factors associated with disease mortality in 170 villages in mainland China and Taiwan, widely known as the China Study. These studies, exceptionally diverse in scope, dealt with diseases thought to be related to varied dietary practices, thus providing the opportunity to investigate diet and disease associations comprehensively. Our project in China, of which I was director, began in 1983. In addition to these human studies, I maintained a 27-year laboratory research program in experimental animal studies. Begun in the late 1960s, this NIH-funded research investigated the link between diet and cancer in considerable depth. Our findings, which were published in the highest quality scientific journals, brought into question some widely assumed fundamental principles of cancer causation. When all was said and done, my colleagues and I were honored to have received a total of 74 grant years of funding. In other words, because we had more than one research program being conducted at once, my colleagues and I did 74 years' worth of funded research in less than 35 years. From this research, I have authored or co-authored over 350 scientific articles. Numerous awards were extended to me and to my students and colleagues for this long series of studies and publications. They included, among others, the 1998 American Institute for Cancer Research Award, in recognition of a lifetime of significant accomplishments in scientific research in diet, nutrition, and cancer. A 1998 award as one of the top 25 food influentials by Self Magazine, and the 2004 Burton Coleman Scientific Award by the Natural Nutrition Food Association. Moreover, invitations to lecture at research and medical institutions in more than 40 states and several foreign countries attested to the interest in these findings from the professional communities. My appearance before congressional committees and federal and state agencies also indicated substantial public interest in our findings. Interviews on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour program, at least 25 other TV programs, lead stories in USA Today, the New York Times, and the Saturday Evening Post, and widely publicized TV documentaries on our work have also been a part of our public activities. Since publication of the first edition of this book in early 2005, I have presented at hundreds of lectures here in the U.S. and abroad, often to medical institutions and their sponsored conferences. Tom has completed 7 years of medical training, including residency, and is a board-certified family physician. Presently, he is an instructor of clinical family medicine at the University of Rochester Medical School, is medical director of our nonprofit organization, the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, nutritionstudies.org, and is co-founder and clinical director of the Program for Nutrition in Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. urnutritioninmedicine.com. That's spelled the letter U, the letter R, nutritioninmedicine.com. He is presenting lectures to the same professional audiences as I am, and has also published a how-to companion to this book, The China Study Solution. The Promise of the Future. Through all of this, both Tom and I have come to see that the benefits produced by eating a plant-based diet are far more diverse and impressive than any drug or surgery used in medical practice. Heart diseases, cancers, diabetes, stroke and hypertension, arthritis, cataracts, Alzheimer's disease, impotence, and all sorts of other chronic diseases may often be prevented. These diseases, which generally occur with aging and tissue degeneration, kill the majority of us before our time. Additionally, impressive evidence now exists to show that advanced heart disease, cancers of certain types, diabetes, and a few other degenerative diseases might be reversed by diet. I remember when my superiors were only reluctantly accepting the evidence of nutrition being able to prevent heart disease, for example, but vehemently denying its ability to reverse such a disease when already advanced. But the evidence can no longer be ignored. Those in science or medicine who shut their minds to such an idea are being more than stubborn. They are being irresponsible. During the past decade, it has become abundantly clear that this message is exceptionally powerful, now attracting a wide public audience in addition to a rapidly growing group of medical professionals. Its time has come, and there is no doubt that it will gradually wend its way into public consciousness. It is the only dietary message that can sustain our future. One of the more exciting benefits of good nutrition is the prevention of diseases that are thought to be due to genetic predisposition. We now know that we can largely avoid these genetic diseases, even though we may harbor one or more genes responsible for the disease. But funding of genetic research continues to spiral upwards in the belief that specific genes account for the occurrence of specific diseases, in the hope that we somehow will be able to turn off these nasty genes. Drug company public relations programs now depict a future where each of us will have a personal ID card cataloging all of our good and bad genes. Using this card, we will be expected to go to our doctor, who will prescribe a single pill to suppress our bad genes. I strongly suspect these miracles will never be realized, or if tried, they will have serious, unintended consequences. These futuristic pipe dreams obscure the affordable, efficacious health solutions that currently exist, solutions based in nutrition. In my own laboratory, we have shown in experimental animals that cancer growth can be turned on and off by nutrition, despite very strong genetic predisposition. We have studied these effects in great detail and have published our findings in the very best scientific journals. As you will see later, these findings are nothing short of spectacular, and the same effects have been indicated over and over again in humans. Eating the right way not only prevents disease, but also generates health and a sense of well-being, both physically and mentally. Some world-class athletes, such as six-time Ironman champion Dave Scott, track stars Carl Lewis and Edwin Moses, tennis great Martina Navratilova, world champion wrestler Chris Campbell, no relation, and 78-year-old marathoner Ruth Heydrich, have discovered that consuming a low-fat, plant-based diet gives them a significant edge in performance. In the laboratory, we fed experimental rats a diet similar to the usual American fare, rich in animal-based protein, and compared them with other rats fed a diet low in animal-based protein. Guess what happened when both sets of rats had an opportunity to voluntarily use exercise wheels? Those fed the low animal protein diet exercised substantially more, with less fatigue, than those fed the type of diet that most of us eat. This was the same effect observed by these world-class athletes. This shouldn't be news to the medical establishment. A century ago, Professor Russell Chittenden, a famous, well-established nutrition researcher at Yale University Medical School, investigated whether eating a plant-based diet affected students' physical capacities. He fed some students, fellow faculty, and himself a low-protein, mostly plant-based diet and measured their physical performance tests. He got the same results as our rats almost a century later, and they were equally spectacular. Then there is the question of our excessive dependence on drugs and surgery to control our health. In its simplest form, eating the right way would largely obviate the enormous costs of using drugs, as well as their side effects. Fewer people would need to wage lengthy, expensive battles with chronic disease in hospitals over their last years of life. Healthcare costs would drop, and medical mistakes would wane as premature death plummeted. In essence, our healthcare system would finally protect and promote our health as it is meant to do. Simple Beginnings. As I look back, I often think about life on the farm and how it shaped my thinking in so many ways. My family was immersed in nature every waking moment. In the summer, from sunrise to sunset, we were outdoors planting and harvesting the crops and taking care of the animals. My mother had the best garden in our part of the country and toiled day in and day out during the summer to keep our family well fed with fresh food, all produced on our own farm. I've had an amazing journey, to be sure. I have been startled time and time again by what I have learned. I wish that my family and others around us had had the same information back in the mid-1900s that we now have about food and health. If we had, my father could have prevented or reversed his heart disease. He could have met my youngest son, Tom, his namesake. He might have lived for several more years with a higher quality of health. My journey in science over the past 6 decades has convinced me that it is now more urgent than ever to show how people can avoid these tragedies. The science is there, and it must be made known. We cannot let the status quo go unchallenged and watch our loved ones suffer unnecessarily. It is time to stand up, clear the air, and take control of our health. Chapter 2. A House of Proteins. My entire professional career in biomedical research has centered on protein. Like an invisible leash, protein tethered me wherever I went, from the basic research laboratory to the practical programs of feeding malnourished children in the Philippines to the government boardrooms where our national health policy was being formulated. Protein, often regarded with unsurpassed awe, is the common thread tying together past and present knowledge about nutrition, and its supposed importance has permeated the practice of diet and health, even on the professional level, in ways that have suffused our very beings. The story of protein is part science, part culture, and a good dose of mythology. I am reminded of the words of Goethe, first brought to my attention by my friend Howard Lyman, a prominent lecturer, author, and former cattle rancher. "We are best at hiding those things which are in plain sight." Nothing has been so well hidden as the untold story of protein. The dogma surrounding protein censures, reproaches, and guides, directly or indirectly, almost every thought we have in biomedical research. Ever since the discovery of this nitrogen-containing chemical in 1839 by the Dutch chemist Gerhard Müller, protein has loomed as the most sacred of all nutrients. The word protein comes from the Greek word proteos, which means of prime importance. This begs the question of why there was such irrational exuberance for this nutrient in the first place, especially given the belief that protein was only present in animal flesh and products. Some have speculated that it was due to people's belief that eating animals might impart strength, endurance, and agility to the consumer. Or perhaps it was related to the human desire to dominate other sentient beings. Whatever the motivation, in the 19th century, protein was synonymous with meat, and this connection has stayed with us for well over 100 years, and has had enormous consequences for our dietary beliefs and practices. Many people today still equate protein with animal-based food. If you were to name the first food that comes to mind when I say protein, you might say beef. If you did, you aren't alone. Confusion reigns on many of the most basic questions about protein. What are good sources of protein? How much protein should one consume? Is plant protein as good as animal protein? Is it necessary to combine certain plant foods in a meal to get complete proteins? Is it advisable to take protein powders or amino acid supplements, especially for someone who does vigorous exercise or plays sports? Should one take protein supplements to build muscle? Some protein is considered high quality, some low quality. What does this mean? Where do vegetarians and vegans get protein? Can vegetarian and vegan children grow properly without animal protein? Fundamental to many of these common questions and concerns is the belief that meat is protein and protein is meat. This belief comes from the fact that the soul of animal-based foods is protein. In many meat and dairy products, we can selectively remove the fat, but we are still left with the recognizable meat and dairy products. We do this all the time, with lean cuts of meat and skim milk. But if we selectively remove the protein from animal-based foods, we are left with nothing like the original. A non-protein steak, for example, would be a puddle of water, fat, and a small amount of micronutrients. Who would eat that? In brief, for a food to be recognized as an animal-based food, it must have protein. Protein is the core element of animal-based foods. Early scientists like Karl Voigt, 1831 to 1908, a prominent German scientist, were staunch champions of protein. Voigt found that man needed only 48.5 grams per day, but nonetheless, he recommended a whopping 118 grams per day because of the cultural bias of the time. Protein equaled meat, and everyone aspired to have meat on his or her table, just as we aspire to have bigger houses and faster cars. Voigt figured you can't get too much of a good thing. Voigt went on to mentor several well-known nutrition researchers of the early 1900s, including Max Rubner, 1854 to 1932, and W. O. Atwater, 1844 to 1907. Both students closely followed the advice of their teacher. Rubner stated that protein intake, meaning meat, was a symbol of civilization itself. A large protein allowance is the right of civilized man. Atwater went on to organize the first nutrition laboratory at the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA. As director of the USDA, he recommended 125 grams per day. Only about 55 grams per day is now recommended. Later, we will see how important this early precedent was to this government agency. A cultural bias had become firmly entrenched. If you were civilized, you ate plenty of protein. If you were rich, you ate meat. And if you were poor, you ate staple plant foods like potatoes and bread. The lower classes were considered by some to be lazy and inept as a result of not eating enough meat or protein. Elitism and arrogance dominated much of the burgeoning field of nutrition in the 19th century. The entire concept that bigger is better, more civilized, and perhaps even more spiritual, permeated every thought about protein. Major McKay, a prominent English physician in the early 20th century, provided one of the more entertaining but most unfortunate moments in this history. Physician McKay was stationed in the English colony of India in 1912 to identify good fighting men in the Indian tribes. Among other things, he said that people who consumed less protein were of a poor physique, and a cringing, effeminate disposition is all that can be expected. Pressing for quality. Protein, fat, carbohydrate, and alcohol provide virtually all of the calories that we consume. Fat, carbohydrate, and protein, as macronutrients, make up almost all the weight of food, aside from water, with the remaining small amount being the vitamin and mineral micronutrients. The amounts of these latter micronutrients needed for optimum health are tiny. Milligrams to micrograms. Protein, the most sacred of all nutrients, is a vital component of our bodies, and there are hundreds of thousands of different kinds. They function as enzymes, hormones, structural tissue, and transport molecules, all of which make life possible. Proteins are constructed as long chains of hundreds or thousands of amino acids, of which there are 15 to 20 different kinds, depending on how they are counted. Proteins wear out on a regular basis and must be replaced. This is accomplished by consuming foods that contain protein. When digested, these proteins give us a whole new supply of amino acid building blocks to use in making new protein replacements for those that wore out. Various food proteins are said to be of different quality, depending on how efficiently they provide the needed amino acids used to replace our body proteins. This process of disassembling and reassembling the amino acids of proteins is like someone giving us a multicolored string of beads to replace an old string of beads that we lost. However, the colored beads on the string given to us are not in the same order as the string we lost. So, we break the string and collect its beads. Then, we reconstruct our new string so that the colored beads are in the same order as our lost string. But if we are short of blue beads, for example, making our new string is going to be slowed down or stopped until we get more blue beads. This is the same concept as in making new tissue proteins to match our old, worn-out proteins. About 8 amino acids, colored beads, that are needed for making our tissue proteins must be provided by the food we eat. They are called essential because our bodies cannot make them. If, like our string of beads, our food protein lacks enough of even one of these 8 essential amino acids, then the synthesis of the new proteins will be slowed down or stopped. This is where the idea of protein quality comes into play. Food proteins of the highest quality are very simply those that provide, upon digestion, the right kinds and amounts of amino acids needed to efficiently synthesize our new tissue proteins. This is what that word quality really means. It is the ability of food proteins to provide the right kinds and amounts of amino acids to make our new proteins, and to do so efficiently. Can you guess what food we might eat to most efficiently provide the building blocks for our replacement proteins? The answer is human flesh. Its protein has just the right proportionate amounts of the needed amino acids. But while our fellow men and women are not for dinner, we do get the next best protein by eating other animals. The proteins of other animals are very similar to our proteins, because they mostly have the right proportionate amounts of each of the needed amino acids. These proteins can be used very efficiently, and therefore are called high quality. Among animal foods, the proteins of milk and eggs represent the best amino acid matches for our proteins, and thus are considered the highest quality. While the lower quality plant proteins may be lacking in one or more of the essential amino acids, as a group, they do contain all of them. The concept of quality really means the efficiency with which food proteins are used to promote growth. This would be well and good if the greatest efficiency equaled the greatest health, but it doesn't. And that's why the terms efficiency and quality are misleading. In fact, to give you a taste of what's to come, there is a mountain of compelling research showing that low-quality plant protein, which allows for slow but steady synthesis of new proteins, is the healthiest type of protein. Slow but steady wins the race. The quality of protein found in a specific food is determined by seeing how fast animals grow while consuming it. Some foods, namely those from animals, emerge with a very high protein efficiency ratio and value. This focus on efficiency of body growth, as if it were good health, encourages the consumption of protein with the highest quality. As any marketer will tell you, a product that is defined as being high quality instantly earns the trust of consumers. For well over 100 years, we have been captive to this misleading language and have oftentimes made the unfortunate leap to thinking that more quality equals more health. The basis for this concept of protein quality was not well known among the public, but its impact was, and still is, highly significant. People who choose, for example, to consume a plant-based diet will often ask, even today, where do I get my protein? As if plants don't have protein. Even if it is known that plants have protein, there is still the concern about its perceived poor quality. This has led people to believe that they must meticulously combine proteins from different plant sources during each meal so that they can mutually compensate for each other's amino acid deficits. However, this is overstating the case. We now know that through enormously complex metabolic systems, the human body can derive all the essential amino acids from the natural variety of plant proteins that we encounter every day. It doesn't require eating higher quantities of plant protein or meticulously planning every meal. Unfortunately, the enduring concept of protein quality has greatly obscured the information. The protein gap. The most important issue in nutrition and agriculture during my early career was figuring out ways to increase the consumption of protein, making sure it was of the highest possible quality. My colleagues and I all believed in this common goal. From my early years on the farm to my graduate education, I accepted this virtual reverence for protein. As a youngster, I remember that the most expensive part of farm animal feed was the protein supplements that we fed to our cows and pigs. Then, at graduate school, I spent 3 years, 1958 to 1961, doing my PhD research, trying to improve the supply of high-quality protein by growing cows and sheep more efficiently so we could eat more of them. I went all the way through my graduate studies with a profound belief that promoting high-quality protein, as in animal-based foods, was a very important task. My graduate research, although cited a few times over the next decade or so, was only a small part of much larger efforts by other research groups to address a protein situation worldwide. During the 1960s and 1970s, I was to hear over and over again about a so-called protein gap in the developing world. The protein gap stipulated that world hunger and malnutrition among children in the developing world was a result of not having enough protein to consume, especially high quality, that is, animal, protein. According to this view, those in the developing world were especially deficient in high-quality protein or animal protein. Projects were springing up all over the place to address this protein gap. A prominent MIT professor and his younger colleague concluded in 1976 that an adequate supply of protein is a central aspect of the world food problem, and further, that unless desirably supplemented by modest amounts of milk, eggs, meat, or fish, the predominantly cereal diets of poor nations are deficient in protein for growing children. To address this dire problem, MIT was developing a protein-rich food supplement called Incaparina. Purdue University was breeding corn to contain more lysine, the deficient amino acid in corn protein. The U.S. government was subsidizing the production of dried milk powder to provide high-quality protein for the world's poor. Cornell University was providing a wealth of talent to the Philippines to help develop both a high-protein rice variety and a livestock industry. Auburn University and MIT were grinding up fish to produce fish protein concentrate to feed the world's poor. The United Nations, the U.S. Government Food for Peace Program, major universities, and countless other organizations and universities were taking up the battle cry to eradicate world hunger with high-quality protein. I knew most of the projects firsthand, as well as the individuals who organized and directed them. The Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, of the United Nations, exerts considerable influence in developing countries through their agriculture development programs. Two of its staffers declared in 1970 that by and large, the lack of protein is without question the most serious qualitative deficiency in the nutrition of developing countries. The great mass of the population of these countries subsists mainly on foods derived from plants, frequently deficient in protein, which results in poor health and low productivity per man. M. Autry, a very influential man from the FAO, added that, owing to the low animal protein content of the diet and lack of diversity of supplies in developing countries, protein quality is unsatisfactory. He reported on a very strong association between consumption of animal-based foods and annual income. Autry strongly advocated increasing the production and consumption of animal protein to meet the growing protein gap in the world. He also advocated that all resources of science and technology must be mobilized to create new protein-rich foods, or to derive the utmost benefits from hitherto insufficiently utilized resources to feed mankind. Bruce Stillings at the University of Maryland and the U.S. Department of Commerce, another proponent of consuming animal-based diets, admitted in 1973 that, although there is no requirement for animal protein in the diet per se, the quantity of dietary protein from animal sources is usually accepted as being indicative of the overall protein quality of the diet. He went on to say that the supply of adequate quantities of animal products is generally recognized as being an ideal way to improve world protein nutrition. Of course, it's quite correct that a supply of protein can be an important way of improving nutrition in the developing world, particularly if populations are getting all of their calories from one plant source. But it's not the only way, and as we shall see, it isn't necessarily the way most consistent with long-term health. Feeding the children. So this was the climate at that time, and I was part of it as much as anyone else. I left MIT to take a faculty position at Virginia Tech in 1965. Professor Charlie Engel, who was then the head of the Department of Biochemistry and Nutrition at Virginia Tech, had considerable interest in developing an international nutrition program for malnourished children. He was interested in implementing a Mothercraft self-help project in the Philippines. This project was called Mothercraft because it focused on educating mothers of malnourished children. The idea was that if mothers were taught that the right kinds of locally grown foods can make their children well, they would not have to rely on scarce medicines and the mostly non-existent doctors. Engel started the program in 1967 and invited me to be his campus coordinator and to come for extended stays in the Philippines while he resided full-time in Manila. Consistent with the emphasis on protein as a means of solving malnutrition, we had to make this nutrient the centerpiece of our educational Mothercraft centers, and thereby help to increase protein consumption. Fish, as a source of protein, was mostly limited to the seacoast areas. Our own preference was to develop peanuts as a source of protein, because this crop could be grown most anywhere. The peanut is a legume, like alfalfa, soybeans, clover, peas, and other beans. Like these other nitrogen fixers, peanuts are rich in protein. There was, however, a nagging problem with these tasty legumes. Considerable evidence had been emerging, first from England and later from MIT, the same lab that I had worked in, to show that peanuts often were contaminated with a fungus-produced toxin called aflatoxin, AF. It was an alarming problem because AF was being shown to cause liver cancer in rats. It was said to be the most potent chemical carcinogen ever discovered. So we had to tackle two closely related projects: alleviate childhood malnutrition and resolve the AF contamination problem. Prior to going to the Philippines, I had traveled to Haiti to observe a few experimental mothercraft centers organized by my colleagues at Virginia Tech, Professors Ken King and Ryland Webb. It was my first trip to an underdeveloped country, and Haiti certainly fit the bill. Papadoc Duvalier, president of Haiti, extracted what little resources the country had for his own rich lifestyle. In Haiti at that time, 54% of the children were dead before reaching their fifth birthday, largely because of malnutrition. I subsequently went to the Philippines and encountered more of the same. We decided where mothercraft centers were to be located based on how much malnutrition was present in each village. We focused our efforts on the villages in most need. In a preliminary survey in each village, barrio, children were weighed, and their weight for age was compared with a Western reference standard, which was subdivided into first, second, and third degree malnutrition. Third degree malnutrition, the worst kind, represented children under the 65th percentile. Keep in mind that a child at the 100th percentile represents only the average for the U.S. Being less than the 65th percentile means near starvation. In the urban areas of some of the big cities, as many as 15 to 20% of the children aged 3 to 6 years were judged to be third degree. I can so well remember some of my initial observations of these children. A mother, hardly more than a wisp herself, holding her 3-year-old twins with bulging eyes, one at 11 pounds, the other at 14 pounds, trying to get them to open their mouths to eat some porridge. Older children, blind from malnutrition, being led around by their younger siblings to seek a handout. Children without legs or arms, hoping to get a morsel of food. A revelation to die for. Needless to say, those sights gave us ample motivation to press ahead with our project. As I mentioned, we first had to resolve the problem of AF contamination in peanuts, our preferred protein food. The first step of investigating AF was to gather some basic information. Who in the Philippines was consuming AF, and who was subject to liver cancer? To answer these questions, I applied for and received an NIH research grant. We also adopted a second strategy by asking another question: how does AF actually affect liver cancer? We wanted to study this question at the molecular level using laboratory rats. I succeeded in getting a second NIH grant for this in-depth biochemical research. These two grants initiated a two-track research investigation, one basic and one applied, which was to continue for the rest of my career. I found studying questions both from the basic and applied perspectives rewarding because it tells us not only the impact of a food or chemical on health, but also why it has that impact. In so doing, we could better understand not only the biochemical foundation of food and health, but also how it might relate to people in everyday life. We began with a stepwise series of surveys. First, we wanted to know which foods contained the most AF. We learned that peanuts and corn were the foods most contaminated. All 29 jars of peanut butter we had purchased in the local groceries, for example, were contaminated with levels of AF as much as 300 times the amount judged to be acceptable in U.S. food. Whole peanuts were much less contaminated. None exceeded the AF amounts allowed in U.S. commodities. This disparity between peanut butter and whole peanuts originated at the peanut factory. The best peanuts, which filled cocktail jars, were hand-selected from a moving conveyor belt, leaving the worst, moldiest nuts to be delivered to the end of the belt to make peanut butter. Our second question concerned who was most susceptible to this AF contamination and its cancer-producing effects. We learned that it was children. They were the ones consuming the AF-laced peanut butter. We estimated AF consumption by analyzing the excretion of AF metabolic products in the urine of children living in homes with a partially consumed peanut butter jar. As we gathered this information, an interesting pattern emerged. The two areas of the country with the highest rates of liver cancer, the cities of Manila and Cebu, also were the same areas where the most AF was being consumed. Peanut butter was almost exclusively consumed in the Manila area, while corn was consumed in Cebu, the second most populated city in the Philippines. But, as it turned out, there was more to this story. It emerged from my making the acquaintance of a prominent doctor, Dr. Jose Caedo, who was an advisor to President Marcos. He told me that the liver cancer problem in the Philippines was quite serious. What was so devastating was that the disease was claiming the lives of children before the age of 10. Whereas in the West, this disease mostly strikes people only after 40 years of age, Caedo told me that he had personally operated on children younger than 4 for liver cancer. That alone was incredible, but what he then told me was even more striking. The children who got liver cancer were from the best-fed families. The families with the most money ate what we thought were the healthiest diets, the diets most like our own meaty American diets. They consumed more protein than anyone else in the country, high-quality animal protein at that, and yet they were the ones getting liver cancer. How could this be? Worldwide, liver cancer rates were highest in countries with the lowest average protein intake. It was therefore widely believed that this cancer was the result of a deficiency in protein. Further, the deficiency problem was a major reason we were working in the Philippines. To increase the consumption of protein by as many malnourished children as possible. But now, Dr. Caedo and his colleagues were telling me that the most protein-rich children had the highest rates of liver cancer. This seemed strange to me at first, but over time my own information increasingly confirmed their observations. At that time, a research paper from India surfaced in an obscure medical journal. It was an experiment involving liver cancer and protein consumption in two groups of laboratory rats. One group was given AF and then fed diets containing 20% protein. The second group was given the same level of AF and then fed diets containing only 5% protein. Every single rat fed 20% protein got liver cancer or its precursor lesions, but not a single animal fed a 5% protein diet got liver cancer or its precursor lesions. It was not a trivial difference. It was 100% versus 0%. This was very much consistent with my observations for the Philippine children. Those who were most vulnerable to liver cancer were those who consumed diets higher in protein. No one seemed to accept the report from India. On a flight from Detroit, after returning from a presentation at a conference, I traveled with a former but much senior colleague of mine from MIT, Professor Paul Newburn. At the time, Newburn was one of the only people who had given much thought to the role of nutrition in the development of cancer. I told him about my impressions in the Philippines and the paper from India. He summarily dismissed the paper by saying, "They must have gotten the numbers on the animal cages reversed. In no way could a high-protein diet increase the development of cancer." I realized that I had encountered a provocative idea that stimulated the disbelief, even the ire, of fellow colleagues. Should I take seriously the observation that protein increased cancer development and run the risk of being thought a fool? Or should I turn my back on this story? In some ways, it seemed that this moment in my career had been foreshadowed by events in my personal life. When I was 5 years old, my aunt, who was living with us, was dying of cancer. On several occasions, my uncle took my brother Jack and me to see his wife in the hospital. Although I was too young to understand everything that was happening, I do remember being struck by the big C word, cancer. I would think, when I get big, I want to find a cure for cancer. Many years later, just a few years after getting married, at about the time when I was starting my work in the Philippines, my wife's mother was dying of colon cancer at the young age of 51. At that time, I was becoming aware of a possible diet-cancer connection in our early research. Her case was particularly difficult because she did not receive appropriate medical care due to the fact that she did not have health insurance. My wife, Karen, was her only daughter, and they had a very close relationship. These difficult experiences were making my career choice easy. I would go wherever our research led me to help get a better understanding of this horrific disease. Looking back on it, this was the beginning of my career focus on diet and cancer. The moment of deciding to investigate protein and cancer was the turning point. If I wanted to stay with this story, there was only one solution: start doing fundamental laboratory research to see not only if, but also how, consuming more protein leads to more cancer. That's exactly what I did. It took me further than I had ever imagined. The extraordinary findings my colleagues, students, and I generated just might make you think twice about your current diet. But even more than that, the findings led to broader questions. Questions that would eventually lead to cracks in the very foundations of nutrition and health. The nature of science: what you need to know to follow the research. Proof in science is elusive. Even more than in the core sciences of biology, chemistry, and physics, establishing absolute proof in medicine and health is nearly impossible. The primary objective of research investigation is to determine only what is likely to be true. This is because research into health is inherently statistical. When you throw a ball in the air, will it come down? Yes, every time. That's physics. If you smoke 4 packs a day, will you get lung cancer? The answer is maybe. We know that your odds of getting lung cancer are much higher than if you didn't smoke, and we can tell you what those odds, statistics, are. But we can't know with certainty whether you as an individual will get lung cancer. In nutrition research, untangling the relationship between diet and health is not so straightforward. Humans live all sorts of different ways, have different genetic backgrounds, and eat all sorts of different foods. Experimental limitations such as cost restraints, time constraints, and measurement error are significant obstacles. Perhaps most importantly, food, lifestyle, and health interact through such complex, multifaceted systems that establishing proof for any one factor and any one disease is nearly impossible, even if you had the perfect set of subjects, unlimited time, and unlimited financial resources. Because of these difficulties, we do research using many different strategies. In some cases, we assess whether a hypothetical cause produces a hypothetical effect by observing and measuring the differences that already exist between different groups of people. We might observe and compare societies who consume different amounts of fat, then observe whether these differences correspond to similar differences in the rates of breast cancer or osteoporosis or some other disease condition. We might observe and compare the dietary characteristics of people who already have the disease with a comparable group of people who don't. We might observe and compare disease rates in 1950 with disease rates in 1990, then observe whether any changes in disease rates correspond to dietary changes. In addition to observing what already exists, we might do an experiment and intentionally intervene with a hypothetical treatment to see what happens. We intervene, for example, when testing for the safety and efficacy of drugs. One group of people is given the drug, and a second group a placebo, an inactive look-alike substance to please the patient. Intervening with diet, however, is far more difficult, especially if people aren't confined to a clinical setting, because then we must rely on everyone to faithfully use the specified diets. As we do observational and interventional research, we begin to amass the findings and weigh the evidence for or against a certain hypothesis. When the weight of the evidence favors an idea so strongly that it can no longer be plausibly denied, we advance the idea as a likely truth. It is in this way that I am advancing an argument for a whole foods plant-based diet, WFPB. As you continue reading, realize that those seeking absolute proof of optimal nutrition in one or two studies will be disappointed and confused. However, I am confident that those seeking the truth regarding diet and health by surveying the weight of the evidence from the variety of available studies will be amazed and enlightened. There are several ideas to keep in mind when determining the weight of the evidence, including the following. Correlation versus causation. In many studies, you will find that the words correlation and association are used to describe a relationship between two factors, perhaps even indicating a cause and effect relationship. This idea is featured prominently in the China study. We observed whether there were patterns of associations for different dietary, lifestyle, and disease characteristics within the survey of 65 counties, 130 villages, and 6,500 adults and their families. If protein consumption, for example, is higher among populations that have a high incidence of liver cancer, we can say that protein is positively correlated or associated with liver cancer incidence. As one goes up, the other goes up. If protein intake is higher among populations that have a low incidence of liver cancer, we can say that protein is inversely associated with liver cancer incidence. In other words, the two factors go in the opposite direction. As one goes up, the other goes down. In our hypothetical example, if protein is correlated with liver cancer incidence, this does not prove that protein causes or prevents liver cancer. A classic illustration of this difficulty is that countries with more telephone poles often have a higher incidence of heart disease and many other diseases. Therefore, telephone poles and heart disease are positively correlated. But this does not prove that telephone poles cause heart disease. In effect, correlation does not equal causation. This does not mean that correlations are useless. When they are properly interpreted, correlations can be effectively used to study nutrition and health relationships. The China study, for example, has over 8,000 statistically significant correlations, and this is of immense value. When so many correlations like this are available, researchers can begin to identify patterns of relationships between diet, lifestyle, and disease. These patterns, in turn, are representative of how diet and health processes, which are unusually complex, truly operate. However, if someone wants proof that a single factor causes a single outcome, a correlation is not good enough. Statistical significance. You might think that deciding whether or not two factors are correlated is obvious. Either they are or they aren't. But that isn't the case. When you are looking at a large quantity of data, you have to undertake a statistical analysis to determine if two factors are correlated. The answer isn't yes or no. It's a probability, which we call statistical significance. Statistical significance is a measure of whether an observed experimental effect is truly reliable or whether it is merely due to the play of chance. If you flip a coin three times and it lands on heads each time, it's probably chance. If you flip it 100 times and it lands on heads each time, you can be pretty sure the coin has heads on both sides. That's the concept behind statistical significance. It's the odds that the correlation or other finding is real, that it isn't just random chance. A finding is said to be statistically significant when there is less than 5% probability that it is due to chance. This means, for example, that there is a 95% chance that we will get the same result if the study is repeated. This 95% cutoff point is arbitrary, but it is the standard nonetheless. Another arbitrary cutoff point is 99%. In this case, when the result meets this test, it is said to be highly statistically significant. In the discussion of diet and disease research in this book, statistical significance pops up from time to time, and it can be used to help judge the reliability or weight of the evidence. Mechanisms of action. Oftentimes, correlations are considered more reliable if other research shows that two correlated factors are biologically related. For example, telephone poles and heart disease are positively correlated, but there is no